This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the National Museum. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Kirsten Wayner. I'm the head curator of the museum's People and the Environment program, and it's my privilege today just to be able to step up and introduce Dr. Daniel Oakman to you, who's going to give the talk today. I will just begin, as I customarily do, by just asking people to remember to turn off their mobile phones, if you happen to have one. So Daniel is a senior curator in the museum's People and the Environment program and has a long-standing interest in Australia's cycling history. I have to say he's also an avid and experienced cyclist himself, one who regularly intimidates me as a enthusiastic but fairly incompetent bike rider, comes in to tell me about his routes and races completed. And I think I mention this because I think, as we'll discover today, one of the particularly interesting things that Daniel brings to his research into Australia's cycling history is his ability to bring to it both an excellent analytical eye, the eye of the scholar, but also the practitioner's and the enthusiast's sense of experience of what it is to be a cyclist. So Daniel's talk today, as you know, focuses on the life and career of Sir Hubert Opperman, exploring how Oppie, as he was known, how Oppie's exploits reshaped Australians' understanding of the body's capacity for endurance and also our sense of the continent over which his great rides were completed. This work is an important contribution to the museum's and indeed the People and the Environment program's developing research program examining how different forms and experiences of energy, transport and movement shape our lives, societies and environments. The National Museum has, of course, a long-standing commitment to original research, and one way through which this is currently supported is through a fellowship program enabling museum staff, such as curators, to step out of their usual relatively hectic positions to spend some time in the museum's research centre really concentrating on a research project. And Daniel's talk today arises out of a fellowship he recently completed in the research centre, and it is, I just want to let you know, it is the first of a series of talks to be presented by research centre fellows. So I would encourage you to look out for news of those in the future. Daniel's work to date on Australia's cycling history will also bear fruit in the future in other ways, notably a touring exhibition that is currently in development that will look at the history of the bike in Australia. This exhibition is scheduled for release in the middle of next year, so I'll just put that on your calendars as well, and to let you know that there'll be more about that on our website soon and we'll keep you posted. So I just wanted to let you know that we are recording today's session, including the Q&A afterwards. Please, if you have a question afterwards, please wait for the microphone to come to you so that we can actually hear it on the recording. And I will just let you know that obviously you then asking a question is in effect giving your consent for us to record it and to publish it on the website. So if you're meant to be at work and you've just snuck out and not told your boss, now's your opportunity to either to make a run for the door. Since you're all going to stay, I'm sure, it just gives me great pleasure to introduce Daniel to you and to welcome him to the podium.
Thanks, Kirsten, for the introduction. I just wanted to begin by saying that usually when I mention that I'm interested in Hubert Opperman, people start to think that I'm talking about Robert Oppenheimer, who was one of the inventors of the nuclear bomb. So if you're here for that talk, this may seem slightly irrelevant. And as talented as Oppie was, I don't think he had anything to do with nuclear physics. But there will be a point in this talk where I will talk about thermodynamic physics, I promise you. Now, today I didn't want to give you just a general overview of Opperman's life. Rather, I wanted to really focus on an important decade, and that decade was from 1928 to 1938. And I think it was an important decade for Opperman, but it was also a really fascinating decade for endurance cycling in general. But just quickly, for those of you less familiar with Oppie's career, he was a champion cyclist in the decades between the First and Second World War. And after the Second World War, he went on to become a minister in the Menzies and Holt Liberal governments. And in fact, played a key role in the demise of the White Australia policy, which is a little known fact, I think, in the history of that policy. Anyway, after he resigned from Parliament, he then became the Australian ambassador to Malta. So you can see he had an extraordinarily varied and diverse life. He died in 1996, and for me, he was really the first Australian to make an impression on the European cycling scene, and he won a string of endurance races in Europe and Australia. He was born in Rochester, in northwestern Victoria, in 1904. Now, his father, who was a butcher by trade but somewhat restless by nature, moved the family around the country while he was searching for work and prospecting for gold. But eventually, to give Oppie some stability, he was taken in by his grandmother, who lived in Melton, on the western outskirts of Melbourne. And this is where he first learned to ride a bike. And once he left school, he began working for the Postmaster's General's office, apparently racing trams as he delivered the mail and developing his cycling skills. He soon began winning races at the junior level and working his way up the various ranks. But after placing in a major cycling race when he was just 19, he attracted the attention of Malvern Star Bicycles, and in particular, the manager of Malvern Star, Bruce Small. And we'll hear quite a lot about him in this talk today, because he was really the other half of Oppie's story. So Oppie then went to work for Bruce, working in the shop as a salesman, but Bruce also allowed him a lot of opportunities to continue his training. For most of the 1920s, he was the national road cycling champion and developed a virtually unbeatable reputation. But I don't really want to talk about those particular races. I want to jump right into when he was just 24 and he first went to France. And that particular year, which was really a definitive one in his life. I've just got a couple of pictures so you can get a sense of what Oppie looked like. That's something else I'll address a bit later on. One of my favourite anecdotes about Oppie is when he travelled by ship to Europe. This is in early in 1928. Now, it was those days, it was a 7-week boat ride, and an athlete stood to lose a lot of conditioning over a 7-week boat ride. So Oppie took his rollers on board the ship and would pedal away for most days. And according to one story, Oppie was pedalling away furiously, and a fellow passenger, a lady, came up to him and said, "You know, what on earth are you doing?" And he said, people didn't know, he had quite an impish sense of humour. He said, "Well, I'm providing electricity for the ship." And she said, "Well, carry on, you're doing a fine job. You know, keep up the good work." So he arrived in France and competed in the Tour de France and distinguished himself in that race. But I really want to skip to a race that he did after that, which was called the Bol d'Or, or the Golden Bowl. Now, this race was undertaken on an outdoor velodrome in Paris, and it ran for 24 hours. So it was a non-stop race running for 24 hours, and whoever could complete the most laps was the winner. Understandably, Opperman wasn't particularly enthusiastic about taking this on, but again, his manager convinced him that this would be the right race for Opperman's particular talents. Now, each competitor was allowed to have two or three paces, which they rode behind, and that would obviously mean they could travel faster and ride further over the distance. This is not a picture of the Golden Bowl event, but just to give you a sense of how a rider could be paced around a track and benefit from the aerodynamics provided by riding in the shelter of a person in front of them. This is actually what was called motor pacing, which was another event that Opperman excelled at, and that's Opperman back there with that rather strange cannonball looking like helmet he's wearing. So anyway, back to the Golden Bowl. The race actually started at 11 p.m. at night, and the early hours of this were quite confusing. But Oppie first noticed that his steering column was shifting wildly every time he went round the banked corners. Then suddenly his chain broke, so he rolled to the centre of the track and picked up his spare bike, thinking nothing more. Anyway, when he went to exert even more force on the pedals, trying to regain his place in the race, that chain also snapped. Now, a second chain break in an event like this is almost unheard of. So Oppie was now bikeless, and he scrambled for another machine and jumped on a friend's roadster. Now, this was a heavy touring bike with mudguards, a lamp, and worst of all, it had very low gears, so he was unable to sustain the kind of speeds that the other riders were achieving. But by now, the news had spread throughout the crowd that Opperman's chains had been sabotaged. They'd been filed through until so thin that they would snap under the extra force. Now losing one lap in every six, the crowd had suddenly found its hero. "Allez Oppie," they chanted when Oppie went past, and then poured a storm of hate over his saboteurs every time they lapped him. So after a reasonable amount of time, his track machine had been repaired, and he remounted that machine, but then pleaded with his pacers to try and make up the 17 laps that he'd now lost. The task, they thought, was impossible. So he yelled to his manager, Bruce Small, to find some more willing pacers. In those days, money talked, and you could simply buy some talented riders to come back onto the track if they'd given up with other teams. So this worked, and Oppen was able to claw back his position. But after 10 hours, he was still four laps behind first position. But by now, after 10 hours of racing, his bladder had demanded attention. Now, having worked so hard to regain his position, he simply refused to leave the track. So he suddenly called to his pacemakers to slow down. They were slightly bemused by this until they heard the crowd roar. And then they saw a long stream of golden urine flying from the back of Opperman's wheel and into the faces of his opponents. It occurs to me that the name of this event seems slightly more appropriate than I first thought. As it turned out, Bruce Small had suggested that Oppie adopt his road practice of not stopping to go to the toilet at all, and he'd taken this advice to heart, and in the days before this particular race, he practiced this technique on a fixed-wheel machine on some quiet roads around Paris. And those of you who understand the difference between a road bike and a track bike, on a track bike, the gear is fixed, so the pedals are always turning as you go forward, which makes this feat even more remarkable. So by now, Opperman's contest had won the crowd's heart. Allez Oppie, they chanted, as he finally overtook the French riders to be in first place. So now, with just 30 minutes to ride, Oppie was the clear winner. He had covered almost 950 kilometres, and just to save you doing the calculation, that's riding at over 40 kilometres an hour for the best part of 24 hours. But his manager saw another opportunity presenting itself. His chase had put him ahead, not just of his competitors, but in that race, but on schedule to beat the coveted 1,000-kilometre record. An exhausted Opperman at first refused. But Small had arranged some fresh pacemakers from the other teams who had abandoned the 24-hour event to help him cover the required 35 miles. It was presumably there was a rider that Oppie hadn't peed on. but he explained to Oppie that if he did the 1,000-kilometre record, he would feel no more tired than he would if he didn't. And not for the last time, Oppie would give in to this irrefutable logic. So he strapped his feet to the pedals and rode for another hour and a half, all to the rapturous applause and chanting of the crowd. So having beaten the best continental cyclist, the sporting journal Lotto celebrated Oppermann as a brilliant champion, a new cycling marvel. And he was subsequently voted Europe's Sportsman of the Year, the only Australian to achieve this honour. But his performance in the Bol d'Or confirmed what the sporting press had suspected throughout that year's Tour de France, that Oppermann was a rare and spectacularly gifted cyclist. The French press dubbed him Le Phénomène, the phenomenon. And as I said, this year really changed him forever as an athlete and as a public figure. And indeed, these are the tales that he would tell for the rest of his life. So he returned to Australia, sporting a beret And this would become very much his trademark, his signature item of clothing. And the museum is lucky to have, in fact, two of Oppie's berets. And you can see he continued to wear it right up until his senior years. Actually, the museum acquired these berets, he sent a letter to us, it's just the year before he died, saying that, in fact, he brought 30 back from France because he was so overwhelmed with his the reception in France and his identification with the cycling culture in that country that he forever wanted a kind of an item of clothing that would remind him of that event. So now with Oppie back in Australia, he went back to France in 1931, where he was again quite successful in the Tour de France. But the part of his career I want to now look at was really his endurance riding, which really came to the fore in the 1930s. Now, his manager really faced a challenge here of how to bring spectators into much closer proximity to his champion. Those close to endurance cyclists often bore witness to the intense mental and physical drama that played out against opponents in a race, but also against their own bodies. From a distance, of course, the seemingly repetitive and unskilled nature of the sport could appear dull. Furthermore, without the action taking place in an enclosed space where the event could be experienced in its entirety, spectators could not see how a record attempt or a long road race might unfold. So Small endeavoured to generate a sense of immediacy and urgency into Opperman's record attempts. A statistic in a newspaper was simply not enough. The cycling adventurers of earlier years, such as Francis Birtles and Arthur Richardson, they had no support vehicles. Their reports and interpretation of their adventures had to wait until either the ride was completed or they reached an urban centre where they might find an interested reporter. More often than not, readers waited days to read a report or an article written by the rider themselves, or waited years for the publication of a book. Small returned after the Tours de France, determined to reproduce that intense physical and psychological drama that had captivated European spectators for decades. So he copied many of the stylistic and theatrical techniques used to promote the tour to promote Opperman's distant records. And it would transform the way Australian audiences experienced and understood the life of the endurance cyclist. I'm just going to do a little digression to tell you about Bruce Small. As you can probably tell, he was quite a magnetic character. Once he sold his shares in Malvern Star in the 60s, I think, he actually became the mayor of the Gold Coast. You can see he's dressed quite appropriately for it in that particular photo. But he, although he didn't invent the phenomenon of the meter maids, he gave it a significant boost. And you can see a couple of the lovely meter maids there, and a tradition that's still with us, I believe, on the Gold Coast. But there you go. He did get involved in a whole lot of investigations with the tax department, I believe. But I'll leave that for now. Now, one of Opperman's early records really set the pattern for almost a decade of record setting in terms of the way it was presented to the public. The Kalgoorlie to Perth journey of some 600 kilometres was a familiar route for many in Western Australia, linking the mining region to the city. But by segmenting this journey, Small structured Opperman's performance into a theatrical event. The division of each record attempt into these identifiable and reportable stages allowed tension and suspense to be woven into an epic narrative that was generated often by writers who were invited to come along on the event, but most dramatically of all by Opperman himself, who spoke on radio as well as to the assembled crowds before, during and after his rides. Now, listeners also keenly waited for hourly radio updates and the broadcast from Opperman whenever he reached a studio along the route. So radio played an enormous role here in enhancing the collective experience of these events, especially as people sort of gathered around them to listen and to learn when Opperman was going to pass through their particular town so they could get to the roadside and catch a glimpse of him. A small time this particular ride to finish in the centre of Perth on the weekend, and in this way he would ensure that the maximum number of people were there to witness the new record being set. And when Opperman arrived, the crowds, in fact, were so large that he had to be carried up a ladder to a veranda above Small's local office. And here he gave a public address, and later in the evening he spoke over the national radio network from his hotel bed. This strategy played out in event after event, helped keep Oppie's name in the papers almost daily for over a decade. Another of Oppie's great rides was the two-week transcontinental record attempt in 1937. All the major newspapers reported his training rides, his physical condition, any minor mishaps that might come up to affect his speed. For his part, Opperman gave talks in theatres about his overseas races, his preparation for this event, with slides and moving pictures. And just as he had done with the much shorter Kalgoorlie to Perth ride, Small had constructed the route as another mobile stage through which a colossal struggle against the land could be acted out and relayed to the nation. He arranged for a special correspondent from the Sydney Morning Herald to accompany the support crew for the entire distance. So like a serialised novel, the combination of regular print and national radio reports gave the event the immediacy and momentum that had not been typically associated with cycling events. For the reporters who followed, their own encounters and experiences of the land became fused with the record attempt themselves. And while Australian journalism lacked much of the lyricism of the European press, it conveyed a very particular understanding of the challenges faced by Opperman and a deeper uncertainty about the land in which the events took place. Australia might have lacked the high alpine passes that animated French cycle writing. Instead, they had miles of the villainous sand and rocky wastes of the Nullarbor, the blistering, uninhabited deserts, icy hilltops in the southeast, and the sun-dazzled highways, as well as the prospect of meeting hostile natives. This is actually a picture of Oppie that was rarely seen, and that's of him in considerable distress. Usually his reputation, of course, was a man with limitless energy. And this photograph, to me, looks like he was taken something by surprise. And it's the only one of its kind that I've been able to find. But it's an interesting aberration. This was a much more common celebration of Opperman as an Australian Superman. This is one of the more inspired images, I think, that I've seen. And the little verse down the bottom says, he covers Australia by means of a bicycle, with legs like a piston and nerves like an icicle, out of the sunset and over the scenery, a knight upon wheels and a god in machinery. So it's good stuff. And really for most of the interwar years, journalists and broadcasters had all referred to Opperman as a human motor, a flying machine or a superman. But I think these were more than just literary flourishes. These phrases really had their roots in the physiological sciences of the late 19th century and the culture of experimentation that grew around studies of human movement and athletic potential. And breakthroughs in thermodynamic physics, see, I told you we'd get there, in the 19th century generated new understandings of energy, fatigue, and the productive capacity of a working body, and in fact, the universe itself. The universal laws of energy applied equally to the movement of the planets, the forces of nature, the mechanical work of machines, and of course, the work of a body. So the language of work also shifted to describe the labouring body as a productive organism capable of transforming universal natural energy into measurable outputs. The social reformers, scientists, engineers and hygienists who began popularising these ideas claimed that measuring and harvesting every source of energy would release a vast reservoir of latent power and produce a civilization resistant to decay and disorder. So these evocative metaphors of human beings as motors or dynamos reflected the newly understood link between human physiology, science, industrial technology, and progress. The cyclist became the perfect embodiment of these associations, the perfect fusion of human energy amplified by a simple machine. It's obvious, I guess, that scientific interest then turned to the question of how to boost athletic performance beyond its known limits. Cyclists themselves, of course, took their sporting endeavours and these experiments to extreme levels, less in the spirit of scientific experimentation, although that was part of it, but in the spirit of competition. One of the most severe tests was the six-day cycle race, which was first run in Britain in 1878. But this is where races would compete for at least 20 hours a day for 6 days. A particularly famous American event occurred in the 1890s at Madison Square Gardens. At this event, the riders were suffering delusions and hallucinations, and many of them crashed after total exhaustion. The extreme nature of this particular event drew condemnation in Australia and around the world. The Argus reported that riders went crazy on the track and dropped unconscious from their machines. One man even sustained a paralytic stroke. Equally unedifying were the mobs of curious spectators, eager to witness the endurance of the human animal under a certain form of torture, I quote from one paper. The New York Times acknowledged the worthiness of this demonstration, but, and I quote, thought that this athletic contest in which participants go queer in the heads and strain their powers until their faces become hideous with torture is not sport, it is brutality. But my point here is that endurance cycling proved the most compelling sporting experiment in which to test the human capacity to operate a machine in a relatively controlled environment. It was still a real question about just how far the human body could be pushed by adopting machine-like efficiency. Now, Opperman himself often spoke of his riding as work or labour. Through training, he looked to achieve an automatic pedalling action where his body would fuse with the bicycle. And he remained fascinated by this process of moulding his mind and body, and I quote, into a smooth working combination, transforming his limbs into a machine-like piston so that the muscular reply to the sensory demand would be as swift and ready as the actions of an unthinking robot. And his ability to ride in a mechanically precise fashion gave him the appearance of possessing limitless energy. Cycling officials often reported and expressed their dismay at his cycling cadence and his machine-like appearance, and felt that it was a display of almost unnatural endurance. In contrast to this, though, Opperman was, I think, distinguished by, I guess it was a contradictory dimension to his character, that he appeared to be a robotic automaton, immune to hardship and suffering. But this had not come at the expense of his essential humanity. And this was a key concern in the period, because it was feared that industrial efficiency and mechanisation would in fact destroy the social fabric. But by contrast, Opperman engaged his public with eloquent speeches before and during and after his rides. He wrote reflective articles in journals and newspapers, and all of these contributed to his reputation as the consummate athlete and the well-rounded sporting gentleman. And in addition to this humanism, Oppie had clearly improved his socioeconomic condition by his physical strength and endurance rather than through his social network or education. This compounded his image as a classless hero, an emblem of a meritocracy based on physical capacity rather than wealth, money, or political connection. And his particular image as this disciplined and wholesome athlete contrast with the reputation of professional cyclists on the continent. European sports novels in the late 19th and early 20th century delighted in depicting talented bike racers as vulnerable people, often falling prey to lustful women who were eager to satisfy their carnal desires with men of prodigious endurance. The unsubtle message, of course, was that it was only through commitment to the bicycle that you would secure a moral and virtuous life. And Henry de Grange, who was the founder of the Tour de France, wrote in one of these novels that your bicycle is your salvation. It will lead you to marriage, healthy, strong, vigorous and honest. That's slightly alarming, doesn't it? It's also worth mentioning the kind of public response to Opperman's body. It was curiously asexual in contrast to the European these European novels and articles about cyclists, in part because I think Opperman was married, but he stood outside in many ways the kind of typical athletic types that were prevalent in Australia. He was only about 5'7" and about 65 kilograms at his racing weight. So I think by any definition, he was not a large man. And most reports of his rides were made comment about his size. It was simply astonishing to people that this little fellow could generate this amount of power. Of course, one of the dominant images of Australian athleticism was the surf lifesaver. And clearly, Opperman did not fit this physical mould. He, in fact, for me, represented an alternative athleticism, an alternative type of masculinity, one that emphasised efficiency over brawn and stamina and mental tenacity over explosive strength. I think, too, as an aside to this, his solo efforts drew a particular attention in the 1930s, particularly his concerns about Nazism and the kind of militaristic overtones of in Germany after the 1936 Berlin Olympics. So often it was reported part of Opperman's appeal and his success was due to his individualism. So he was held up as an example of individual talent, rather than being a kind of anonymous, slightly, you know, the military overtones of these kind of images. So I think we're starting to see how Opperman's particular talent, his particular physical prowess, came at precisely the right time, and at a time of some crisis in Australian history. The late 20s and 1930s, there was a general climate of economic dislocation and national crisis, and a very much a sense of a society recovering from the First World War, searching for a kind of physical and spiritual regeneration. Falling birth rates, the widowing of thousands of women after the war, many who didn't remarry, all triggered concerns about the nation's fertility. The presence of deformed and limbless returned soldiers also increased the cultural value of physically gifted athletes like Opperman and our lifesavers here. It was also a general quest for an industrial efficiency, but also a concern about what that industrial efficiency might mean. So the other kind of images which were coming up in photography and art brought a lot of these ideas together. So there was a real interest in what might happen with the combination of human labour and machines, and whether that might sort of disrupt the capacity of society to sustain itself. Many communities were also still recovering from the outbursts of household violence, drunkenness, and other social dislocations caused by the war, and Opperman's teetotalism, which was often illustrated with him drinking milk or having healthy ice cream and these kind of things, came with a particularly potent symbolism. And again, it was all part of his this wholesome, virtuous athlete, and he easily became a powerful symbol of national aspiration. I think there's also something deeper at work here, and I want to talk a little bit about Oppie and the way he challenged the way Australians perceived themselves and their continent. Throughout history, every form of propulsion has changed understandings of distance and time because of the particular way each technology has moved the human body through space. While motorised transportation in the form of the railway, the motor car and the aeroplane may have destroyed the so-called tyranny of distance, the bicycle played its own role in reconceptualising Australian understanding of space, distance and time. Bicycles brought the human form into a distinctive kind of relationship to the land, quite unlike that experienced in a motorised vehicle. Now, while Oppie's journeys were intended to prove his athletic strength rather than understand the landscape that he was passing through, the representation of his cycling feats nevertheless contributed to, I think, a distinctive appreciation of the continent. And it was something of a paradox that his efforts reinforced the kind of scale, the hostility and vastness of the Australian landscape, but they also rendered it far less abstract in bodily terms. The distances between towns and cities, indeed across the continent, had been measured bodily in distance, time, and, as some newspapers calculated, the tons of force required to push one's way across it. They did a calculation of how many kilograms of pressure was required by each pedal stroke, and then made the calculation of how many tons Oppie was pushing to cover the continent. Now, this is not to suggest that earlier endurance riders did not have a profound impact. They did. But that generation of riders framed their accounts around notions of travelling and exploration. Where their journeys were expeditionary in nature, Oppermann's were shaped by a stronger focus on the science of human performance. And I think his contribution differed in two ways. Firstly, his celebrity and iconic status generated an unprecedented level of coverage and interest. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, was this concept of repeatability, and that his events were more precisely measurable, quantifiable, and therefore improvable. And the regular contesting of these events and these records all sustained an idea of continuous physical improvement. And I don't think that the attention devoted to his efforts produced necessarily a more objective or richer understanding of the land, but I think that he helped reframe the country into a different set of cultural and social imperatives, grounded in a desire to measure the nation more precisely against the human form. And that by using a common and accessible technology, that measurement had a much greater meaning for many Australians. So in some ways, these journeys tied Australia's distant centres together in a distinctive way, and one that resonated powerfully at a historical juncture with people looking for ways to bring distant cities in Australia together. So Oppermann, I think, was seen to bring the boundaries of the nation together and render them within the reach of human potential, albeit through sacrifice and suffering. And I use those two words deliberately, sacrifice and suffering. They're words long associated with cycling, but they've also been important ideas in Australian history. And the nationalist historical tradition, which has emphasised suffering like the Anzacs and tragedy like Burke and Wills, have all revolved around an idea of legitimising the possession of the land. And the historian Andrew Lattas has written that in this powerful mode of history, and I quote, "The land becomes a testing ground. It represents a challenge to prove the worth, character and mettle of those who wish to claim her. This is the space of the pioneer, explorer and artist. Each of them is involved in giving birth to our sense of nationhood. Each represents a figure for colonising the land, for gaining over it some kind of spiritual possession." Their suffering takes on the epic proportions of a pilgrimage that redeems and heals the nation. It is also, I would suggest, the space of the endurance athlete. And for the sake of this argument, I think we can see Opperman's feats as being framed in this way as well. Oppie's suffering saw him literally leave parts of himself across the country, sweat, tears and blood in the event of a fall. And even though he was clearly an unusually talented athlete and he achieved his goals in extremis, this merely magnified the sense that superior physiological mental capacities were required to occupy the land and that ordinary people should aspire to these traits. And in this sense, this was a validation of the place of white Australians on this continent and a comment on their potential to thrive here. I'll conclude in the next 5 minutes. I think Opperman's story was an athletic drama that unfolded over the interwar period and helped shape the way Australians thought about themselves, their own bodies and the continent they inhabited. And as the Second World War approached, journalists and other commentators increasingly drew Oppie's sporting feats more explicitly into accounts of national capacity, efficiency and race patriotism. Oppie's efforts always drew passionate prose from Australian journalists, but the prospect of war supercharged the popular response to his feats of endurance. In late September 1938, Oppie attempted the Launceston Hobart cycling record. As he approached Hobart, he was on schedule to complete the journey of some 400 kilometres in under 12 hours. Thousands of people stood along the route, blocking traffic. A mounted police in the centre of town struggled to contain the cheering spectators. On arrival at the town hall, two policemen hoisted Oppie to their shoulders and carried him inside to be received by the Lord Mayor and his deputy. There he is. The Mercury newspaper celebrated this ride in, I think, quite a striking way. And I apologise, it's a long quote, but I think it's worth it. So the paper celebrated this as a striking feat of physical skill and endurance on the part of one man. It is the fighting spirit displayed in such feats of endurance that finds its equivalent in even sterner contests. So long as Australia has men to perform such feats and others to cheer them on, the nation will worthily acquit itself in whatever it is called upon to achieve. This great gathering of citizens was a stimulating indication of public calmness and detachment when on the verge of a world-shaking crisis. Proof of the orderly mind that accompanies British blood and further evidence that with the most awesome situation can be faced by the British peoples without panic. So I hope in this talk I've given you a more complex impression of Hubert Opperman and his place in Australian history and the broader cultural dimensions of his sporting life. And I'll leave you with a final thought that while Oppie was certainly, we can see, very much a man of his time and for his time, his iconic status was in fact sustained by a much older idea that had bubbled away since the late 19th century and powerfully shaped Australian self-perception about the kind of people that would be required to colonise and cultivate this country. And that idea was a powerful utopian fantasy about the promise of a body and through it a nation without limit and without fatigue. Thanks for listening. Happy to take questions.
Thanks for that. In your research, was there any mention of the dietary requirements or things that Opperman did to maintain his endurance?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually, and I found it fascinating to the kind of things that he was taking. I think would be completely at odds with what cyclists are taking today. Notably the lack of carbohydrates, eating lots of fruit and apples and things like that. And frankly, from my own cycling efforts. I can't imagine getting anywhere on that kind of fuel. But yeah, you get sort of steak and eggs. So not the kind of things that I think cyclists today are really thinking about. But it will certainly of interest. And coffee, because he was a teetotaler, so there was this emphasis on sort of drinking milk and coffee was kind of his apparent fuel of choice. But there's, you know, there is, of course, a debate about whether he was taking some kind of performance-enhancing substance.
I certainly don't want to refer to performance-enhancing substances, but and I'm sorry I missed the first bit, but did you find out about his difficulty in getting Australian teams over to the tour and the work he had to do, I guess, to raise the money to get the second lot across in 31?
Yeah, I didn't particularly focus on that. I know that the first Tour de France for him in 1928 was a problem because they only managed to get four team members. So it was Oppie, two Australians and a New Zealander. They were meant to team up with another four riders in France who didn't turn up. So they were in fact racing against teams of 8 to 10. Now even in, you know, today's kind of the way the race is run, that would be difficult. But back then they raced a lot of these stages as team time trials. So of a 20-stage race, 10 of them were team time trials. So they were riding with four against 10. So it was extraordinarily difficult for them. Oppie ended up coming 17th in that first tour, largely on his own because his teammates turned out they were unable to keep up with him. But they did have to raise money in that early period to head across, and did that through, you know, various appeals in newspapers and so on. But I don't know about the 1931, whether that was more difficult. I know they had a proper team. They had I think 8 or 9 on that one, so it was a little easier.
During the 28-38 period that he was achieving so much, how did the design evolution of the bike help him, or was there not a great deal of change at that time in the actual weight and gearing and everything with the bike?
Yeah, look, I'm not really an expert. There may be other people in this room who know more about the technological changes. I don't know if there was a kind of a spectacular change. I mean, the kind of basic shape of the bike had been fairly stable for some time. I think probably the introduction of derailleur gears was probably the major one. I think they weren't allowed gears in the Tour de France because Henri de Grange felt that was somehow a lesser event to actually have gears. You know, his idea of a good Tour de France when one person finished because everyone else was literally sort of collapsed on the side of the road. So in some ways, you know, the technological advances were actually removed from the Tour to enhance the kind of physical spectacle.
In the 28 to 30 tours, they had rear wheels that had a cog on one side and a cog on the other, so they would just simply undo the wing nuts, switch the wheel around to climb, so they had
like
one
that.
Cog for climbing. And it was also that period that they introduced the Alps for the first time, so that was a big change that made it significantly harder. But in 30 or 31 on, that's when they started to have two or three gears at the back only, and a mechanical lever front changer. Mm. So it was a period of great change, and in those rides of Oppie's in Australia, he would have had the benefit of 2, 4 or 5, I'm not really sure, gears, but it was,
wow,
this was the period of change.
Thanks.
Thanks. Can I ask two questions? Well, that's three now, actually. I'm just, you know, you said they described him as a machine and stuff like that. I'm just thinking, it made me think of Bradman as well, and he was described as a machine. Do you think part of it was just people just like describing people as machines at that time rather than anything about Oppie himself? Because it seems a coincidence that both of them were...
Absolutely. I think, you know, and it's still used today. People, you know, prefer to sportsman is performing like a machine. I mean, I just think those cultural connections back to the late 19th century are more revealing of kind of the broader, you know, cultural concerns in that period. But it's interesting. I mean, the comparison with Bradman is a good one because, and also with Farlap, because the three of them were all known for their endurance. And that, I think, is the quality that's really being received a kind of heightened level of interest. So, you know, those kind of phrases take on a particular kind of potency.
Okay, that leads really well into the next question because I'd forgotten about Farlap at that time. But so you've got Bradman, Farlap and Oppie, and it seems of the three, the one that is far less known now and somehow it's disappeared a bit as Oppie. And do you have any idea why that is? Like, you know, Oppie's far less known in the public now than Farlap or Bradman, who are both absolute legends. I mean, Oppie's a legend too, but, you know, far less people know.
And in fact, Oppie was asked this question why for the 1960s, why his cycling legacy was less well known. And Oppie was slightly facetiously said, oh, it was because of Farlap. But that kind of knocked him off the pedestal. But I don't agree. I think it was actually to do with partly because Oppie became a politician, and he was, you know, he was very prominent. He was 17 years in Parliament, Ministry for Immigration, and was part of, you know, incredibly controversial changes to the White Australia policy. I think that was part of it. The other part of it was, for me, the kind of really the rise of the motor car. The idea of cycling changed culturally in the 1920s and 30s. Riding across Australia was incredible. I think in the post-war period, it was seen as absurd. I know the cyclists in this room will have encountered this idea today that why would you do it when you had mechanical assistance? So there was that cultural change. So I think kind of cycling became, at least for me, something that's was devalued. And, you know, there's all sorts of changes to the cities that kind of diminished the role of cycling. And we're only, you know, now in the last 20 or 30 years starting to see that culture shift back, thankfully. So, I mean, that's, you know, just sort of off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, I mean, we live in a city that's designed in the 20th century and, you know, it's all for cars. So.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Did you? Oh, Jessica, just wait for the mic. Thanks.
Yeah, it's just a simple question just about the his race bikes in Paris. Were they just all of steel construction? Was aluminium?
Yeah, I can see Greg shaking his head. They would have been steel, yes.
Just all steel.
I don't know how heavy they would have been.
Hi, Daniel. Thank you. That was very interesting. I was in response to the gentleman who asked about the idea of bodies as machines, and what you were talking about while you were talking about him, and how psychology has become so much a part of sport today, that the three, particularly, I can't say talk for Farlap, of course, but someone like Bradman and Oppie, obviously had more. It was more than just their bodies that drove them, and I think it sort of came back to that time of Descartes and the dualism of the body and the mind, and how scientists believed that bodies could just be treated like machines and that they were machines, and that medical practitioners could look at the body as a machine and fix different parts of it, and we still do that. We replace parts of it as you would a machine, but for me, when you were talking, it really struck me that he must have had an incredibly powerful mind, or, you know, his discipline. That doesn't come from the body. It comes from a very powerful mind and a powerful ability to control himself and push himself, which is not a bodily...
No, that's a really good point. And he... And the other thing that made him different is he would actually reflect on that process, which was highly unusual for an athlete to be so articulate about their sport and what they went through. So he would often be quite, you know, he would be really honest about his kind of suffering and the kind of mental torment that he would be going through. But yeah, no, it's a great point. One more?
I was going to ask, what items does the museum hold of his cycling career?
Good question. We've actually got two collections from Sir Hubert himself. They're made up lots of kind of racing licences, items of clothing, that kind of material. We don't have a bike, which is a real shame, but we're looking for one. So if anyone has one, come and see me. Yeah. So we only have it's a fairly small collection, but it does have some gems. Like the beret is a really terrific iconic piece of clothing from him. So, but yeah, we do would love a bike. Which I might just conclude actually on that. The part of my research is going into, as Kirsten mentioned, developing a travelling exhibition about the history of cycling in Australia, and that's really going to be ongoing work for the next year or so. So we will be putting some stuff up on the website about some objects that we're interested in looking for, and maybe some other public programs that we're hoping to get off the ground. But so please stay tuned and look at the website for more cycling related stuff. But thanks again for coming, and this will be on the web, I think, shortly.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.